We have one mission at the program: develop better leaders and create more cohesive teams.
Let's go, man. It's a race.
Welcome to the Program Podcast. The Program is a team building and leadership development company that works with more than 160 collegiate and professional athletic teams and corporations throughout North America annually. And I'm Eric Kapitulik, the founder and CEO of it. The Program believes that individual talent affords us the opportunity to do well in life. Individuals and individual talent wins games. But great teams compete for championships on whatever our chosen battlefield may be. And great teams are comprised of great teammates and great leaders. Joining me today on the Program Podcast to help us become great teammates and leaders is Chris Warner, a leadership educator, author of High Altitude Leadership, which I strongly recommend to our audience. He is a keynote speaker, Emmy-nominated filmmaker, and entrepreneur, founding Earth Treks, a chain of climbing gyms that is now one of the largest in the nation, serving more than 1 million customers per year. He is also one of America's greatest mountaineers, as reported recently by Outside Magazine. On September 20th, Chris Warner scraped the ceiling of the earth for the fifth time this season, summiting Manaslu at 26,781 feet, the eighth highest mountain in the world. The 58-year-old is now the second American to summit all 14 8,000-meter peaks, the 14 mountains of the world taller than 26,247 feet. Chris, thank you so much for joining me and us today.
Thanks, Eric. It's an honor. I want to talk to your editor, though, because I'm actually now 59 years old and still kicking ass. So I'm pretty psyched about that.
We're going to talk about that, actually. I like that attitude. Yeah. Yeah, I like that. All right. So 59-year-old. And by the way, you just spoke to the editor. So noted.
Yeah. Chris,
one of the last things I did in the Marine Corps was I worked at the Naval Academy as an admissions director and teaching leadership, a little bit of the blind leading the blind, right? But when working there, one weekend, there was a big lacrosse recruiting weekend, and the head coach asked the gentleman, Captain Thorpe, a nuclear submariner commanding officer, and asked Glenn Miles, F-18 pilot, fighter pilot. He asked us to come and speak to the recruits. And so we all spoke. And afterwards, the head coach, Coach Mead at the time, spoke to the recruits and their families. And he said something that's always stayed with me. He spoke to the recruits and the families and said, you know, look, I know at this point, this decision you're going to be faced with to come to the Naval Academy is very daunting. You've spent time with our lacrosse players, midshipmen. You see they take 21 credit hours per semester. They have military obligations on top of that. All of their athletic in lacrosse obligations. They then graduate and you hear from guys like Captain Thorpe and Glenn Miles and Eric Kapitulik about being members of nuclear submarine teams, flying F-18s off of jets. He listened to Cap about jumping out of the airplane and diving in the ocean. And he goes, and it all seems sort of overwhelming, but he goes, you know, when you understand when you talk to them though, you realize that it's just not that big a deal to them. And the reason why is that, like with everything in life, once you do it, it's just what you do. And all of these things that you've heard about, if you come to school here, it's just going to be what you do. Okay, that's true. It's really true. But it took me a long time, though, to appreciate that although it may have been just what I did, it, and looking back on it, it was still pretty freaking awesome. You just became the second American to ever summit all 14 of the 8,000 meter peaks in the world. Do you think of it as just, it's just what I do? Or do you appreciate that what you just accomplished is world-class, blow your mind, unbelievable?
Both. Yeah. The reason is, I truly believe it's what I do, but it's not who I am. There's a difference. Yeah, yeah. And if we become overly identified with what we do, which so many people do in life, then I think we certainly limit ourselves, because I wasn't, you know, I didn't just go on a 24-year journey to climb the 14 8,000-meter peaks, right? And in the process of that, I failed 14 times. So I was on 28 expeditions. 50% of the times I failed. I mean, you and I were together on Nanga Parbat in Pakistan in 2008, and we made the hard decision to fail. And that same, on that same mountain, that same week, if you remember, two people died from two different teams. So
yeah,
we may
talk about that. That's funny. Yeah. Funny you bring that up. I thought about that in preparation for today, and I want to talk to you about that. Yeah. Later.
Yeah. But go ahead. Well, that was a mountain. It took me four times to reach the summit. Mm. And when I finally reached the summit this summer, I think it was the only mountain I've ever cried on the top of, because it was so hard won, that summit, you know, so many deaths, so many failures over so many years. Mm-hmm. Yeah. It was brutal, but it's, we can't identify. I don't want to be identified by what I do. I want to, as I said, I want to be identified by who I am. And, you know, you also talked a little bit in the intro about my business success. You know, like we built the first national chain of indoor climbing gyms. We had 1,000 employees serving 1 million customers a year. I sold that business. I'm completely retired from it for the last 6 years or so. But that was an amazing accomplishment, but it was the same thing. Like I never wanted to be myopic and be overly identified with just what I do. Like, you know, I'm not an accountant. I'm not a life insurance salesman. You know, I'm not a plumber. You know, I'm just this guy who's like ridiculously curious, who's got this kind of weird obsession with goals, you know, who really tries to be the best version of myself all the time. Yeah. And you need all those skills, because life is just way more complex. And this is something that you would completely relate to. And one of the things that I've always admired so much about you is, you know, I'm not sure if all your listeners know the story of the helicopter accident off of San Diego and how you lost what most of your team was killed in that accident, right?
Yeah.
This weekend, some good friends of mine were on a peak called Chichapengma, which is the 14th highest peak in the world. And two different avalanches came and killed four of them and injured three. And in the rescue, another person was injured. But I was the one who had to call the family and of this one woman and tell her that their daughter was dead, and then counsel them through. I mean, that counseling is obviously not done. And not just counseling her, but there's a whole community of us who are suffering right now because of this tragedy. And this is why I'm glad about who I am and not really what I do, because it's that combination of stuff that's really allows me to be there to serve other people when they need it most. And you remember how hard that was, you know, like the families, the people who don't understand what we do, but you still have to guide them towards some level of acceptance, you know?
Yeah. The Chris, first of all, I'm sorry for your loss. I read that story about the avalanches on Chichapengma and the climbers' deaths. I'm sorry for your loss, and I'm both sorry for you, but I think, I don't know if the word is grateful.
That is the word.
But I'm grateful that you had the experience of, as devastatingly difficult as it is, hard as it is to call someone and tell them that their loved one just died. You know, In the helicopter crash, there were other people that had to go to the houses. And I don't want to say have to, because it's actually, and I mean, if you're selected as the person to do that, I mean, think of the honor of that, that, that for, So I don't want to say have to, but other people had already spoken to the families of my deceased teammates, so that when I met with them, that hurdle, that challenge was already over. I once, when I was in the Marine Corps, and I have spoken about this, I once was asked to go and tell a Marine's family that Jason Mollio, had young Marine, had just died in Iraq. And I went, I know you have to, you couldn't be forced to do it. Like, you couldn't be commanded to do it. You had to volunteer for it. And I volunteered, and I went home that day. I put on my dress blue uniform. I drove over to this family's home, drove up their driveway, got out of my car, walked up the steps, rang the doorbell. And Chris, it's something I will never, ever forget. I mean, I will never forget standing there and knowing that when that door was answered, I was about to ruin Leah Hall's life. Me, not the bad guys over in Iraq. No, who shot their son. No, me. And it's why that experience profoundly changed me to this day. And one of the numerous ways it has is I challenge my children. You cannot use the word hard inside of our home. If you come over to our house and talk about climbing K2 is hard, my son and daughter will say to you, no, not hard. Challenging.
Yeah.
It's a challenge, because standing on that doorstep and ringing the doorbell, you calling that family and letting it ring until they answered, that is hard. Everything else in life is challenging.
Yep. Yeah. Yeah. That it is amazing when you think you have this vision of yourself, and then the second those words are trying to come out of your mouth, like you just start shaking, and you know, like I'm crying harder than you're about to cry. Yeah.
Yes.
And I have to deliver this information.
That's right.
But you know, this look, when I look back on my business successes, and you know, I sold this business for tens of millions of dollars, you know, like it was every possible way that you could judge an entrepreneurial success, it was on paper. But the two greatest successes I've ever had to do with families of employee families who were going through horrible tragedies. One was a couple that worked for me, and their 4-year-old son fell inside their house just playing around and suddenly started crying like he's never cried before, and they rushed him to the hospital, and they found that he had a Weems tumor, so it was childhood cancer. And this is on a Sunday afternoon, and I get the call shortly afterwards. And first thing to do is to reach out to this family, and like, number one, don't worry about your job. Like, we'll cover both your salaries. We'll do everything there can. We will be there for you in every possible way. And it wasn't just like I could step up and make that financial decision. But other people had to do things like, bake them food, give them hugs, clean their house, do all that other stuff and be there for them in 1,000 different ways. So it was a community that came together to shepherd these people. And at one point they were, when this happens to a family, usually it's financially devastating for them. I mean, it generally leads to bankruptcy. And they were sat down with a social worker, and the social worker said, hey, here's the truth of your future. Like, you're going to lose your job. You're probably going to lose your house because you won't be able to pay your mortgage, et cetera. And they turned around and said to women, oh no, our boss called us and said, don't come to work. Doesn't matter how many years this takes. We're covering you. Like, it was just like, what a, an amazing leader. Like, as a leader, this is why we're put on this earth, to do those things. Yeah. The second one was another guy who worked with me forever, and started having some weird health issues. They, he went to the hospital, and they found out that he had a form of cancer that nobody had ever survived, that the average lifespan was 8 months from diagnosis. And so I raced over to his house. He had a wife who was pregnant, and they had a young daughter, and he was a super handy guy. So he was remodeling this house, total fixer upper. And I walked in there, and there was a huge hole in the kitchen floor and the whole thing. And first thing I did was like, here's a check for $20,000, hire a contractor. Like, you can't be doing this work. And the same thing, you're on disability. We're hiring your wife who never has to show up to work because we're going to make sure that you guys are financially whole through this whole process. And again, the same thing, the community totally rose to the occasion. And, you know, here was just like we were talking about before of serving other people in need, right? Being there for that family. Here was, you know, a dozen people who got to experience the power of that experience, you know, of being there for other people and serving them. You know, leadership, and one of the reasons I love your podcast and your approach is that leadership is unbelievably hard. And there's too much cliche out there. There's just too much fad. There's too much, I don't know, rosiness, fuzziness. Let's not be as hard as the job is going to demand us to be. Right. And a lot of businesses are suffering because of that, because they don't have the leader who can stand up and, you know, do the hard thing when the hard thing needs to be done.
Mm-hmm. That's right. That's right. And you know, it's interesting, and we will talk about it later, but those examples that you used of like, you know, your great accomplishments, right, as an entrepreneur, and you point to those two, not the selling of the bit, right?
Not putting tens of millions of dollars in my bank account.
That those two things were, you were in a position, and what allowed you to do those things financially is because prior to that, you did the challenging things that a leader is required to do to have a successful business, to employ those people, to, when things go bad, have the resources to support them, that it was your ability to do so was a byproduct of your being and being the leader that is able to have the courage, the toughness, the discipline to do the challenging things every day. And we'll get to that here later. But yeah, thank you for that. It's amazing. All right, now that you and I have brought down the entire audience to kick this thing off.
The program podcast sponsored by Kleenex.
That's right. Great, Chris. I thought it was so cool, you know, that, and it's, and for, you know, look, don't ever trust a guy who says, trust me. Right. I mean, but I think a lot of people who read of your accomplishment, and then, you know, and I'm going to talk about this, but upon accomplishing this most recent feat, you were famously said and quoted of, you know, well, why did you do it? And you famously now said, just for the fun of it.
Yeah.
Don't ever trust somebody who says, trust me, but for our audience, trust me, I've known Chris for a very long time. And maybe some people would be like, what a line of BS, just for the fun of it. No, I know you truly did this just for the fun of it, but I understand that. But, you know, 8,000 meter peaks of the world, as you just highlighted, those were the successful attempts, let alone all of the ones where you didn't make the summit. Now, but you did do it just for the fun of it. And I understand that. But listen, I'm messed up in the head, too.
Right.
for our audience, many of whom are much more normal and more sane people than you and I. Can you explain how climbing an 8,000 meter peak, let alone 14 of them, is fun?
Yeah. When I was a kid, I built tree forts. To me, like 59 year older climbing to the summit of some giant peak is like climbing into a tree fort. Like the view, like literally I am up there, you know. It's like the tree fort meets endurance sports, because it's you know, like there's an imagination thing that goes through your mind when you're in the tree fort, right? It's all about, you become this explorer or whatever it is when you're up there, right? And then, mm-hmm. you know, the dopamine, like the joy that you get. I mean, look, you're a triathlete. I mean, you get it. Like there's something that happens, like you're at mile 22 of the marathon section of Kona, but like you're smiling and you're like, holy cow, this is awesome. Like, you know, like the heat waves coming off the pavement are like an hallucination, you know, like, and you, it's just, there's such joy. Like whenever it gets hard up there or challenging up there, I don't want your kids to beat me up here, but it's, you know, you just look up, and I love climbing at night. Like it is so awesome. You just look up and see the stars. Like instead of looking at your feet and like, oh my God, here's another, you know, I got to step into another foot deep, you know, thing of snow for the 6,000th time in the last 4 hours, you know, and somehow have the strength to push my body forward. It's like, no, look at the stars. Oh my God, there's a shooting star, or like, you know, glade that distant ridge. Like I just, there's a joy that I've been blessed with that just keeps, you know, it comes out in those experiences. And that's not, it's sadly, it's not common enough, you know, like it's a little easier, I think, to have that same joyous experience when the environment is not so risky, you know, like a little bit easier, I think, on a trail run or a mountain bike ride or something. But, you know, I think maybe it's because I've been doing this, you know, I've been climbing internationally since 1987, right? So that's, you know, I've been going to the Himalayas for 4 decades. So I think maybe it's a little bit of just having been up there so much that I'm just much more comfortable than most people up there. So, but it is, it is fun. And that's what does keep me coming back. Like there was, you know, look, we know tons of athletes who podiumed in their prime. And then, you know, they can't podium anymore. And then they're like, okay, let's just say you like really running marathons. Like, do you give up marathon running because you can't win? Like, is there any other joy that it's giving you? And like, and then you become an old marathoner and you're still like, well, it's Sunday. I have nothing else to do. Why don't I go find 20,000 people and go running with them for the day? And you're just like, I'm not going to quit just because I can't move the sport forward anymore. You know, I had those days in mountaineering where I, you know, was literally moving the sport forward. I was trying to be, you know, the greatest, you know, manifesting all of my talents and opportunity. Now I'm like, I can't be that person anymore. Now I need to use oxygen. I need to climb with Sherpas. I'm just not, you know, I'm 59 years old. I don't want to give it up. But I also realize that I can't play at a world-class level. Like I just play at my level. So, but I want to keep playing.
Couple things. First of all, I had the misfortune of knowing you at your world-class level and climbing with you at your world-class level, and the humbling experience that was, I'm still in therapy over. My ego has never recovered from climbing with you at that time. Number one. Number two, you know, it's so interesting to me that you just said it that way, right? About the joy. And that you have and looking up at the stars, right? Just like yesterday, my son is 12 now and plays a lot of sports, likes a lot of sports, but does a lot of different things, right? For what it's worth, I'm against the single sport, like just do this one thing all the time. Like, oh my God. But anyway, so he plays football, basketball, lacrosse, you know, whatever. Anyway, so but just recently at 12, he's asked me, hey, I'd like to start to work out, lift weights and stuff. Right. So, oh my God, how awesome is this as a dad? Right. Okay. Hey, let's go. I'll take you. Right. So yesterday, Columbus Day, doesn't have school. I pick him up at a buddy's house where he spent the afternoon, picked him up at 5:15. He had spent Saturday night, he had spent Sunday night at his other friend's house, very late night, okay? But we had made plans to go to the gym when I picked him up at his friend's house yesterday. So I pick him up and we're driving home or driving to the gym and he's tired. He's yawning. He's like, oh my God, Dad, I'm so tired, you know? And I go, okay. I said, hey, do you want to go to the gym or you want to go home? Your call. And he said, no, I want to go to the gym. I'm still going to go. And I go, okay, your decision. So we go to the gym and we have a very challenging workout. And we leave the gym and are walking out of the gym. And I said, hey, Axel, I go, I just want to tell you just how proud I am of you right now. I said, you just did something that most people never figure out. I said, you're tired. You're hungry. It's the end of the day. You don't have to do this. And you chose to go and do something challenging. And now how do you feel right now? And he was like, oh, he goes, I feel so good about, and I said, yeah, I go, you know, that feeling you have right now about yourself, nobody can give that to you. You have to earn that feeling that you have right now. I said, most people never figure it out. I said, but you know what? I go, for dad, I said, that started at your age and it's become a drug for
me. Yeah.
You just want it, right, Chris? Again and again and again. Mm-hmm. And how do you get it? By doing the challenging things. But oh, what joy it brings you, right?
Yeah. Yeah. It's kind of funny watching what's happening in the 8,000 meter. Like, you know, so I guided Everest first in 2000, and mm-hmm. I have 24 years of climbing 8,000 meter peaks. And in 2003, I guided the first ever reality TV show on Everest. And mm-hmm. that was a real inflection point, like where suddenly we really brought the non-climbing community into the mountains. And mm-hmm. since then, you know, there was other reality TV shows. And now, like, look, you see what happens on this peak. You've summited Everest. I've summited Everest. It's a completely mm-hmm. different mountain now than it used to be. And mm-hmm. it's interesting being there with so many people who put in the absolute minimum required to reach the summit. And sadly, this weekend during this massive avalanche, a really good friend of ours was helping with the rescue, and he fell 150 meters, right? So almost 500 feet, and had a part of his skull was fractured. He broke his tailbone, multiple ribs, and he was bleeding all over the place, and he had to self-rescue. There was no one, like there was no physical way that someone could have carried him down because of the terrain. And mm-hmm. when you think about these other people who put in the absolute minimum, when those, you know, if something bad happens up there, they're just going to die. And you step over the dying all the time. I mean, you know, when you were on the North Ridge of Everest, there was 8 dead bodies that you had to step over to get to the summit. And all those people, sadly, they died on their way down because they sat down. They gave up. You know, it's the mountains rarely kill anybody. People kill themselves in the mountains. And you know, it's human error which causes those deaths.
Do you look at mountaineering as risky? Do you think of it as you're risking your life climbing?
Hell yeah. Yeah. Yes. But I've you know, like, I understand the consequence because I've at 5 different times I've turned around on my summit push to rescue people, and of 2 or 3 of those times they didn't live, you know, mm-hmm. but I gave up. I refused to step over a dying person to reach the summit, which happens all the time. I mean, it was a huge story this summer when, you know, about 150 people stepped over a dying Pakistani man on the summit day of K2 to reach the summit. I mean, there was more, chances are he would have died of his injuries, but there was more than enough resources to have him die during a rescue than die just sitting there.
Yeah.
Yeah. And that stuff, I can't even tell you how badly it bothers me. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Yes. It bothers you, right? Not just as a climber, but as a man.
Yeah.
A human being.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah. And you know, it's so, like, Cap, I know, like, this podcast is so much about death, Sally, but I remember the first person who died in my hands, and his soul passed through my body. He was a complete stranger. I was giving him CPR and I literally felt his soul pass through my body. And you know, I'm not a religious person. I'm not a metaphysicist. I don't know if this is really true, but that's what I felt, And then they taught me, though, the most important lesson ever, that
yeah,
the soul or the person when they're leaving, the emotion that they should be feeling is love, not fear. Was I scared in that moment? Hell yeah. This man had actually had fallen out of a window, hit an electric wire, was electrocuted, and then the body bounced off the electric wires and hit the pavement. When I gave him CPR, there was no rib cage. Like, I was pushing almost to the concrete. And, you know, it was you couldn't give him mouth to mouth because his lips had been fried by the electric wires. That taught me that my job was not necessarily to save lives, but to give love to this, to that soul as it was leaving. And you and did you know Rod Richardson, Rod K2 Richardson, Lieutenant Colonel, Marine Corps?
Oh, of course.
Marine Recon?
Of course.
Yeah.
Of course.
So he and I were, for the readers, Rod Richardson is maybe the greatest warrior of the last 60 years. Two tours of duty in Vietnam. He had been shot four times in the back in Lebanon. He'd been in every single firefight the U.S. had been in except for Grenada. He left our expedition in K2 to be Hamid Karzai's head of security. He went off to Iraq, and he first worked for Blackwater and then Fortress Group. And sadly, he was killed by Al-Qaeda in a ambush in right outside of Iraq. And he, when he was killed, even though he wasn't, you know, he was a former Marine at that point, the Marines raced to the scene and they transported his body completely, you know, back to the United States, even though he was no longer a Marine. Right. I mean, everybody loved him. Well, he and I were on K2 together, and we were with 12 other climbers. We were at the base of the mountain, strapping on our crampons, ready to go towards the summit. And a body came flying out of the sky. I mean, this body went 5,000 vertical feet. It hit after about 1,000 feet, a gigantic explosion of red, bounced another 500 feet, another explosion of red. It was obvious this man was dead. But his body landed 500 feet away from 12 of the best climbers in the world on the trail. And Rod and I were the only two to run to the body. And we got there. So here you are with the biggest badass ever, who had seen more trauma, more death than probably anybody else we know. And Rod and I, you know, two middle-aged men, we held hands for a few minutes. And then we gently put our hand on this man's body. And he was completely destroyed. His hips were pulverized. His legs were underneath his head. His back of his skull was crushed in, and blood was everywhere. And Rod and I, all we did, we just put love into his soul without ever saying a word. But we needed to stop first and hold each other's hands. And then we put our hands on this man's body. And every time I've been in that situation, you know, like, that's my job, is like, okay, I just have to push as much love into them as I possibly can. That was what this weekend was about. That's what it was like with, you know, those two families that, you know, had these horrible cancer situations. Like, you know, this is your job, to give love. An interesting aside here. You know, I worked with the coaches of the Ravens when they won the Super Bowl, and their weight room, which you could imagine an NFL weight room. I mean, you've been in them, but, you know, your listeners could imagine, like, there's big dudes in there, man. And they're pushing weights, and it's like testosterone, aggro, screaming, like, you just, it's like intense.
Yeah.
And you know what word was emblazoned on the wall of their weight room? Love. It was their core value when they won the Super Bowl. And I was I know, it was so cool. And like, you guys get it. And they totally get it.
Yeah. I some of the toughest men I know, the toughest people, men and women that I know, kindness is a core value of theirs, almost to a person. The toughest people, physically, mentally, emotionally tough, resilient people, they are inherently kind human beings.
How much
when I was climbing,
how much do you think humility, how much of that caring, kindness, love, do you think comes from humility?
Well, you know, Chris, I was going to ask you the question. I think, I mean, all of it.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
Like I had, you mentioned the helicopter crash earlier. There'd been another experience I had while in the Marines as well. You might call it a near death experience, but when I was on Mount Everest doing one of the acclimatization climbs prior to the summit attempt, there was an avalanche just ahead of me. Killed two men. I mean, right ahead of me. Okay. And you spoke just now of this, watching this climber fall 5,000 feet to their death, and you and Rod go running over there and are there. When you experience that, it rattled me. Truth be told,
it
rattled me. After an experience like that, how do you continue to climb up after experiencing that? Courage or some other experience, some other, how do you handle that adversity?
That one, I had to go home. I mean, I can't even tell you. After, like, you know, like in the moment, the adrenaline's racing through your body. You do everything you need to do. We packaged this man up, Rod and I. We lowered him down to where these other people were. We needed 60 plus people to help rescue him. I was literally covered in his blood and parts of his brain and everything else on the outside of my Gore-Tex jacket. And in the moment, while we were waiting for people to come from base camp to help us, it's that same moment that people have, like, after a car accident. Like, after the car accident, you run around, do everything, but then you sit on the curb, and all of a sudden, it hits you. And, man, I had 1,000 knives shoved in my gut. I cried so bad, and I lost it, and I went home. And when you quit on K2, especially back then, you know, it was a 6-day walk to the nearest car, and then a 2-day drive to the nearest airport, and a 2-day flight home. You know, that was 10 days of, like, the most serious pouting I ever had. But I was back on the mountains the next year, you know, like, because it's, you know, it's, look, I don't, we need, you know, a serious therapist here, because this is the same thing. Why do warriors go back? You know, like, part of it is, you know, part of it really is because of the PTSD. Like, we kind of don't feel like we have a choice. We have to go back, you know. Our brother, you know, like, our fellow warriors need us, whatever it happens to be. But there's also, you know, there's a truth that when we are tested like that and the best in us comes out, that experience of being the best version of yourself, like being the physically the best version, the emotionally, intellectually the best version of yourself, that's addictive. You know, that's what makes a great entrepreneur. You know, that's what makes a great athlete. And we, when we've tasted what we're capable of, you know, those of us who are competitive, whatever, we want more of that. You know, here I am at 59 years old, you know, like, I'm still out there crushing it. You know,
that's right.
Yeah.
You know, it's interesting too, talking about what you were saying earlier, because I help coach my son's teams. And one of the things that's always funny, I ask the kids at the beginning of the year, always, is winning important? And, you know, they've been told their whole life, most of them, no, not important. And I quickly dismiss that and say, okay, well, on this team, I want you to be very aware, winning is important. It is. And I hope you remember this in life, because if you do not win enough, you will be out of a job. You will not be able to afford your house, food for the table. So winning's important. But I just as quickly highlight now we understand that and we're aware of that on this team. But now we're going to be focused every single day of being the best version of ourselves. That's what we're going to stay focused on. Yep. And if we can stay focused on being the best version of ourselves every single day, then winning is going to be a byproduct of our doing so. Interesting to hear you talk about that. And ultimately, Chris, I feel like that's my definition of success.
Yeah. That is probably the thing I miss most about having a company and having 1,000 employees, is because I loved the whole environment, culture that you created that allowed everyone to be the best version of themselves.
Mm-hmm.
And, mm-hmm. you know, it's like, it takes a whole breadth of skill to understand, you know, like to get into a little bit into the psyche of each of those employees to figure out what lever do I need to pull with this person that I don't need to pull with that other person. Mm-hmm. And especially because as you know, like when you're talking to say, you know, 1,000 of your employees versus 20 of your employees versus one of your employee, right? Like how you message that, et cetera. So the demands that it places on you as the leader to be so intentional, like intellectual about what you're doing, you know, which is why, you know, guys like you and I, and, you know, the people listening to this podcast, like why we spend so much time studying leadership and learning is because we don't want to just be intuitively great. We want to be intellectually great. And when we're just intuitively great, we actually get it right about 80 to 90% of the time. But the 10% that we get it wrong really bothers us. And the other thing too is we can't coach if we're just intuitively great. Because if I just tell you, oh, if you ask me like, what makes you a great leader? I'm like, and you just kind of spout stuff out. Like you never really reflected on what made you a great leader. You don't really know, right? Like mm-hmm. you're actually doing a disservice to this person who asked that question, because you're like telling a telephone game of, you know, cliche and fad, et cetera, as to why you're a great leader, instead of really understanding why you truly were a great leader. And when we had the company, I gave all of my people lots of tools, because, you know, like, look, you can't shut down a retail operation at night unless you have a checklist, right? Like, okay, we got to mm-hmm. take the money out of the cash register. We got to count it. We got to, you know, close this out. We got to lock the doors. We got to clean. Like this checklist for lots of things in life. And the checklist makes us just more efficient. But there's also mm-hmm. checklists on how we treat other people and what they need. And one of the greatest checklists that we ever had, and, you know, this is, you know, like what I love is, Nick, we all steal ideas from everybody else, but I don't even remember who I stole this from, but there's six psychological needs that everybody has as a member of a team. Mm-hmm. And, you know, they are respect, recognition, meaning, autonomy, personal growth, and belonging. And what we would do is we'd give people an Excel spreadsheet, especially if you were a new manager, and be like, okay, put all of the names of your direct reports on the top line. And these are the six psychological needs, and then grade yourself every week. Did you meet their six psychological needs? And the truth is, if we're not meeting people's psychological needs, we will make them dysfunctional. And all mm-hmm. of us who've ever had, you know, like we all enter our new jobs, super enthusiastic. All we want to do is to be the best version of ourselves and be super successful. And then we get there and other people make us dysfunctional, right? Those leaders who think they know, you know, like how to be good leaders, but, you know, but don't really, you know, like who don't put the right emphasis on the right things, which happens all the time in business. Like it drives me crazy, the influence that people put on things like KPIs, you know, like measurable things like that. Like, no, it's like, actually, I'm going to paraphrase this, but, you know, like there's the old saying that which, you know, only that which can be measured can be managed. Mm-hmm. And that's actually a total bastardization of the original quote by Drucker. And his quote was, you may have heard that which must be that can be measured, you know, can be managed. This is untrue, right? So, because it's all of these subtle things that really make up the biggest difference. Like ultimately, as a leader, what we're trying to do is to get people's discretionary energy oriented towards our team's goals. And how do we get their discretionary energy oriented? Like, yeah, so you're at work for 8 hours a day and I get 5 good hours out of you or whatever. But I want the person who wakes up at 2 o'clock on a Wednesday night solving our problem, right?
Yeah.
Like, that's the kind of person that we want on our team. And you get that out of people by like meeting their six psychological needs, you know, like by truly being the best leader that you possibly can be. So,
Chris, the flip side of that is that every relationship, and this is something we talk about a lot on this podcast and with our clients, is and you mention it, and I don't disagree with you on any of it, that leadership is challenging. You have to do a lot. But you're only 50% of the relationship. Now, of that 50% of the relationship, you must take 100% responsibility for it. If this relationship is going to be successful, I must take 100% of the responsibility for it. But so do you. Now, what makes someone a great teammate in on the world's largest mountains, tallest mountains? Is it the same thing about what makes someone a great teammate at Earth Trex? Is it the same things that make somebody a great teammate elsewhere? How does the teammate take 100% responsibility?
Okay, my brain has gone 1,000 different directions. The short answer is yes, right? And really it comes down to your core values, right? That's like, this is how, you know, what we're doing is climbing the mountain, but how we do it is based on our core values, right?
Yes.
Especially as you're trying to scale an organization. So I started my company with $592, you know, part-time, you know, like, and, you know, grew it into, you know, this massive company. And so we had all of the scale that we had to do. And our core values was like beyond critical to the success of the company, because ultimately we wanted the customer to be treated in the same way that the founder always treated the customers. And so, you know, that was like, okay, do we all share the same core values? But you started this comment with something that really struck me. And it's this whole idea of the responsibility that we have to each other. And, you know, sadly the buck, literally the dollar bill stops with the owner, founder, leader, right? Because we're the ones who, when the shit hits the fan, we're the one who have to pay to clean up the mess, right? We have to pay for the lawyers, we have to pay for everything else. And it doesn't mean, though, that the leader is responsible for all of the actions of their employees. Because, you know, just like with your children, you are not 100% responsible for the actions of your children. They might be a completely different person in the schoolyard than they are at home, right? And so many times when I look back on my career and the thousands of employees I've had, the ones who really made my life the most miserable were the ones who ultimately manipulated me, who, to my face, acted one way, you know, always put on, were the person they knew I wanted to see, but who they were when I wasn't around was completely different. So this is the, you know, you talk about why leadership is so hard. One of the reasons is because you're going to be manipulated. You're going to be taken advantage of, and you're going to have to pay for that. And talk about being lonely. Like, you know, it's brutal. And, you know, we happen to be in a business with incredible risk. I mean, 2 times a day, an ambulance would be at one of our gyms, right? And, you know, people falling off the bouldering walls or whatever. And, you know, they would go and for $250 hire a lawyer to write a letter that would cost me $10,000 to answer. You know,
like it's,
There was tons of risk. It took a lot. It took so much courage.
How do you develop? So now the flip side of that, though, of course, would then be so there's those relationships, but then the success of your business is on having is all the other relationships, which are based on trust. And the unwavering trust, even despite those, I feel for you, right? Just the horrible trust and really things where, I mean, God, Chris, I think about some of those relationships I've had at the program where, and through my life, really.
Yeah,
where
through your life, yeah.
I mean, I just think like, oh God, why didn't you see that coming? How did you not see it? Like, really shook my foundation. Well, but the truth is, though, in that, in those kind of islands of despair, it's surrounded by a sea of relationships that I've had that, I mean, I'm so fortunate I've had. They've allowed me to be who I am, achieve if I have achieved anything, achieve, you know, what I have. And all those relationships are based on trust, unwavering trust. How do you develop that trust, whether it's on the mountains of the world or in business?
Well, you have to be trustworthy, right? You know, it's the same. Yeah. It's really the same thing with respect, right? Like, you know, as the leader, you have to treat everybody with respect, and then you have to earn respect, right?
Yes.
You give it and you earn it, right? So to get it back, you have to earn it, but, you know, you have to instantly give it. And it's the same thing with trust. Yeah. And this is, you know, like, I think when people, I struggle with the word authenticity when we talk to leaders. And I think people have misunderstand what authenticity really means in a leadership context.
Okay.
Like so Confucius had this great line. Like, somebody asked Confucius, when can we kill the king? And if you know much about, you know, Chinese culture, like, there was definite roles and everybody played a role. And Confucius' answer was, well, you can kill the king when he's not the king. So if the king is not acting kingly, then that's when, you know, he's no longer the king. And we as leaders need to act all the time like the leader. I mean, this is why it's a lonely position, right? Because you might have 1,000 employees that you absolutely love and that you can have fun with at times, but you really can never be one of them. You know, like, you're always separate, and you need to be separate. And to tell you the truth, they want you to be separate. They don't want you
100%.
To be- Yeah,
100%.
Because they want you, you know, when they need it, they want you to be hard on them. When they need it, they want you to hug them, you know, like, whatever it is. But
the same is true, by the way, as parents. Your 100%. Kids have enough friends. They want a mom, a dad.
Everybody.
Yeah. Go ahead.
Yeah. Yeah, everybody does better in an environment of caring discipline, right?
Yes. So, yes.
Yeah. But, yes. But a lot of people in leadership positions don't quite have all the emotional intelligence they need. So we are constantly watched as leaders, and what the authenticity that people expect us is that we're bringing the authentic emotion to the thing that we're experiencing right now. Like, if you ever go to a movie and you watch it and you come out and you say, the plot was pretty cool, the actor, that was the wrong actor for that role, right? Like, that person just couldn't embody the emotion that the character should have been showing. And we see this a lot of times in business, where you have you don't have the authentic, or, you know, the accurate or the realistic emotional response to the situation that you're in. Like, you weren't sufficiently sad or angry or happy or, you know, proud or grateful or whatever it happens to be. And people look at that, and all of a sudden they realize that leader doesn't quite get it, right? Like, they're missing something. They don't know. And, you know, I found, for me, the way that I was the most authentic leader, right, brought the right emotion was where I spent, literally physically where I lived relative to my employees. I never had an office. In the old days, I had a desk in our communal admin space. But the most important employees in my company were the ones who dealt with customers every single day. And a lot of times they were part-timers. So I'd come in the gyms and I'd spend 10 minutes with, like, you know, the accounting marketing people, and 4 hours sitting at the front desk talking to some part-timer, right? Having a blast. But you also then, you knew exactly what the customer wanted, right? Like, I was out there with the customers. I was a product of our product, you know?
Yes.
And and that was what real authenticity, you know, that allowed me to be completely authentic, you know?
Chris, I've interviewed a good friend of mine, Rob Hale, for this podcast. I'm blessed, real business mentor of mine. He's on the Forbes billionaire list, part owner in the Celtics, right? Like, all this stuff, right? And Rob Hale, when you go to his company, thousands of employees, hundreds of millions of dollars in revenue, you go to Rob's company, his desk is out on the floor with everybody else.
Yeah. Yeah. Yep.
That's it, right?
Yeah. 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 You have to be.
Yeah.
But look, he could only do that because he loves doing that, right? It's just who he is as a person, right? Like, that's wants to be, you know, like, dude, I had the greatest conversation with a janitor. Holy shit.
Yeah, that's right.
Mops can hold 1.2 liters of water. You know, like, that's the kind of guy he is, right?
Yeah.
And that's like that enthusiasm, that curiosity, you know, that accessibility, like, he's always learning. You know, it's look, we could hit like the top 10 things of great leaders and it would be super fun. But I like one thing that jumped out at me when you said it was the mentor word. Like 100% of my success was due to the mentors that I had. And I didn't know anything. I never stepped into a business class until I actually taught one, right? I didn't know anything about accounting, marketing. I knew how to tie knots, right? Like that's what I knew how to do. You know, and then you built built a business that was doing tens of millions of dollars of sales. Like I needed people to who were patient, who loved me, who I could call at 2 o'clock in the morning, which I had to do on numerous occasions because the shit had hit the fan, and they were there for me and I could talk to them for an hour and a half at 2 a.m, get off the phone, call them back 5 minutes later. Cause you got to repeat everything you said to me. Cause I'm just too, I need to hear it again. I need to hear it again.
Yeah.
And, you know, luckily for me, I look back at that same mentor group. They're still my best friends. You know, they come and visit me and stay at my house, sleep on my couch. And these are also millionaires and billionaires. And they do this and they sleep on my couch in Aspen. And, you know, we got fly fishing and hiking and skiing and all their stuff. Cause these are the greatest friendships you could ever have. And when you see so few entrepreneurs seeking out and developing mentorship relationships, because so many of them think that they know it all.
Chris, you talked about humility earlier. You asked the question about humility, right? And it's so funny because I live my life, and the great leaders, the great people, the people I want to spend time with, I seek out, right? Is based on this. Here's Eric Capitula, my humility. Chris, do you know why I'm a genius? Because I know nothing.
Right.
You want me to show you an ignorant man? I'll show you somebody who thinks they know everything.
Yep.
I love people say, don't talk politics and religion. Why? I'm not a child. Why? I can't talk politics and religion. I'm not a child. Like, and not only that, like, I love if you believe something different than me. We're all a sum of our experiences, all of us. And you've got different experiences than I do. I have different ones than you do. You believe certain things. I believe other things, possibly. Great. I can't wait to talk to you about these things, right? And look, don't try to change my mind. Don't try to prove that you're right to me. I'm not going to do that to you. Just let's communicate here. I know I know nothing. I could be so wrong, and God knows I have been so wrong about so many decisions in my life, in my business, in our business, you know, at the program. And like, I know that like history has shown that our finances have shown that, right? Our lawsuits, the number of lawsuits we've had have shown that. And that's why I'm a genius. Yeah. I know nothing. And that thirst for just getting better, right? Like, God, it's really, to your point, it is a consistent universal truth with a capital T. And the great leaders that I know.
Yeah. Yeah. It's not, again, it's not what you do, it's who you are. And like being insatiably curious, like childlike level of curiosity is like, that's who you are. And that's, you know, and you think about the listeners in this podcast, like, okay, there's kind of a reason why we'd be able to build high performance teams, right? Not because we knew how to do it, but we were endlessly curious about how to do it. That's and we wanted to scale it up, and we wanted to teach other people how to do it. And like, okay, we were deeply curious. Like you talk so eloquently about debriefing, and just a quick statistic for the listener, teams that debrief do 20 to 25% better on whatever business metric you measure them by. So if you want to increase your profitability by 20 to 25%, have after action reviews, have debriefs, right? Yeah. And as you say all the time, look, ultimately there's three drivers of results for any kind of, you know, to achieve a goal. You need the right tools, you need the right techniques, and you need the right behaviors. And 75% of that success is dependent upon the behaviors, not the tools and techniques. So when we're having these debriefs, how much time are we spending talking about behaviors, right? Especially our own. Yeah.
That's right. All right, Chris Warner, I could, man, I gotta bring my family. We gotta head to Aspen and I gotta spend some time fly fishing with you, because I could talk to you all day, but we could. I got two questions for you before we wrap up here. Okay, Chris. One, and we started it, you mentioned it. So Chris and I, we tried to climb Nanga Parbat, the world's ninth tallest mountain in the world, a few years ago. It's known as the Killer Mountain. Unsuccessfully, right?
Yep.
You saved my life. You're Chris Warner. So if Chris Warner says, let's climb, I shut up and climb. But you said on that fateful day, let's return to base camp. And we returned to base camp. Later that night, we watched and listened as two climbers lost their lives on that mountain. Mm-hmm. I never forget it. I've never forgotten it. What guides you in your decision-making process in the world's most forbidding environments? What can we learn from that decision-making process?
Okay. I think that sixth sense is actually the subconscious ability to process data.
Say that again.
The sixth sense is the subconscious ability to process data.
Okay.
So your gut is telling you something, right? And if you're, you know, like clearly we train our mind to this. I mean, holy cow. Think about being an infantry officer, right? The first time you're in a firefight versus the 20th time you're in a firefight. I mean, you're a completely different human being, right? Because you've learned what data is important, what data is not important. And so you are able, your processing ability is greatly improved. You know, I have led over 200 international expeditions. You know, mm-hmm. I've, you know, had level 3 avalanche training. I've had all this first aid training, all of this rescue training, like all of this stuff, right, to help me process data. And, you know, you pick up the clues and, you know, you say, okay, this is, you know, maybe I can't in this moment quantify it in a way that I would win an argument against you about whether to turn around or to go up. But my gut is telling me, giving me a strong enough feeling that I know that, you know, we're going to go down. And, you know, thankfully you're the kind of person in that situation, you were smart enough to trust my gut, right? And, you know, whereas that doesn't always happen. It didn't happen this weekend. People went up in obvious avalanche danger, fresh snow, high winds, cold temperatures, slopes at the perfect angle to slide. And, you know, and the first avalanche happened 2 hours later. The first avalanche happened, killing 2 and injuring 3. And the other people were above them. And they were, you know, they just didn't think, you know, that any of these, you know, laws of physics applied to them. And they got caught in the second avalanche and killed. So anyway, we need our subconscious, and we need to learn to trust our subconscious. Because it's processing data subconsciously.
You know, Chris, on Nanga Parbat, it was not a does it change at all for you, that decision making, how difficult it is to make that decision to turn around? Does it change at all for you personally when you're leading a group of climbers that have paid you money?
Oh,
vice Vice Nanga Parbat, where we were a group of friends, right?
Yep.
And
yeah.
But on Nanga Parbat, though, I mean, you're still Chris Warner. That was an impressive group of climbers, present company yep. excluded. I mean, I'm just a hacker out there, but I mean, it's an impressive group. Vice, when you're leading, as you talked about early, maybe the people who have done the least common denominator to be there, does it change at all for you or your thought process in those situations?
No, and it's not, you're not allowed to. You can't have a separate set of rules for your friends than you have for your clients, right?
Yeah.
In that environment, because yeah. people will die. And look, I had to call the family this weekend.
Yeah.
In any negotiation of when it comes to life or death, it's not me versus the paying client who is negotiating it. It's me versus the mom, right? Yeah. She's the higher authority in this negotiation, not you.
Yeah.
You can hate me for that decision, yeah. right? I've ruined yeah. all your dreams. I've embarrassed you in front of your friends. But you know who's going to love me? Your mom, right? And yeah. if I try to appease you, and I used to say this to clients on Everest, right? So people would pay, you know, $50,000 for us to guide them to Everest. And I'd sit them down at the beginning and say, look, I don't work for you. I work for your mother. And they'd be like, you know, yeah. like whatever, 45-year-old dentist, whatever. Like, what do you mean? You know, like I'm a grown man. I paid the money. My mom, I'm like, no. Because if you die up there, your mother's going to come and haunt me, right?
Yes.
like, yes. I would much rather have you pissed and your mother happy. So.
Yes.
Because we yeah. make those phone calls. You know, you've knocked on that door. It is, man.
It never leaves you.
No. And
it never leaves you.
They didn't sign up for that shit. You know what? No. Gina's family, they're just a normal, hardworking family. They've never been on a mountain. They don't understand any of this. They don't understand the allure, right? They don't understand the obsession. They don't understand, you know, the joy. They don't understand the views. They don't understand any of that. It's all just some weird thing that we do. And yeah. but they pay the consequences.
That's right.
Yeah.
I'd like to close with a final question that you wrote about and I've heard you speak about. Interestingly, it's something that we at the program have learned the hard way ourselves as an organization. And based on our earlier conversation here today, you learned as well at Earth Treks. It's also something that we teach every one of the 160 athletic and corporate teams with whom we work annually. The two questions or axes you were judged on in life,
yep.
and why are they important?
Okay. I think I may have stolen this idea from Clay Christensen, the brilliant Harvard business professor who sadly passed away. And if you have a chance, you should read an essay of his called How to Measure Your Life. And it is, you can get find on the Harvard Business Review, but it's brilliant and every leader should read it. And it starts out great.
Your life.
Yeah. And, yeah. You know, one of the things he says in there is, you know, like about how, you know, he talks about how great these Harvard MBA students are going to be, but please don't go to prison. He talks about, you know, like the HBS, you know, alum who were huge business successes and then, you know, ended up in prison because they did it by cheating, stealing, lying to get ahead. So yeah. Anyway, it's a pretty phenomenal, is the final thing. But basically, if you hold your hand up in front of you like the letter L, so hold your left hand up and you have one finger, you know, pointing upward and your thumb pointing, you know, as the horizontal axis. We measure people in life based on these two axes. So the vertical axis is, what do you deliver for strategic results? Like, are you delivering strategic results? So are you delivering sales? Are you like getting the tasks of your job done? You know, like, are you a brilliant engineer? You know, like, et cetera. The other way we measure people is on this horizontal axis. Are you aligned with my core values? Mm-hmm. And if you think about this as a group of squares, right? So the bottom square would be, you don't deliver strategic results and you're not aligned with my core values. Like, clearly we've all worked with those people, you know, I put myself through college by working in construction. So like, I know all about, you know, like that kind of a group. Right. And then you go further on that scale and you have somebody who's okay. Now you're aligned with my core values, but you don't get anything done. You know, this is, this is generally like a person that's really nice at work. We really like them. Like, hey, on your birthday, they made you brownies, or, you know, like they always are kind of there smiling, you know, like they have pictures of their puppy dog that they show you, you know, et cetera. And then if we go further up the vertical axis, right? So people who deliver strategic results, but are not aligned with our core values. And you guys talked about this so brilliantly in one of your podcasts about the hardest decisions that leaders have to make. It's that person that holds us hostage.
Yeah.
They are technically brilliant. They are the rainmaker salesperson. You know, they are the engineer who solves all of our code problems, et cetera. Yeah. But they are the most arrogant, most difficult person to work for. You know, they drive, you know, like they literally, they drive everybody crazy. And then you have the other top axis, who are people who deliver strategic results and are aligned with your core values. Those are the A players. Those are the team members that are required. That's a high performance team. And as you guys said in your podcast, which is totally true, and we know this statistically, when you're one of those people, you deliver strategic results, you're completely aligned with the core values, you know, like you make profit and possibilities happen for your company, right? When you have to work with those other people, those other three quadrants, it frustrates you so bad. In fact, 83% of people report that they're going to leave their job because of those other people. 97% report a loss in productivity because of those other people. Why aren't you being productive in that moment? Because you're dealing with somebody's petty drama.
Yeah.
Right. You're correcting their mistakes. You're doing whatever. Right. Or you're making excuses for that, you know, that super salesperson. And the cool thing is, you know, like this has been studied as well, is when you get rid of that person that's been holding you hostage, you know, that rainmaker person, and they go on to their next job, they almost always fail. And the reason is because just like an alcoholic, your company was expert at enabling that person to be successful, right? Mm-hmm. While they were holding you hostage, you built all of these systems, right? This nurturing environment for that person to be brilliant. And as soon as they go to the next place that doesn't have all of these enablers there, they fail. Yeah. So ultimately, you know, you and I know this as, you know, leaders, like our job is to focus on those people in that upper quadrant, right? That's people who are aligned with our core values and that deliver strategic results. Those are the only people that matter in our company.
And in our life, personally and professionally.
Yep.
Right? I mean, as you talk, I'm thinking about it. Oh God, professionally, but really personal life too. Who do we spend our time with, right? I mean, we have a fleeting amount of time. How do we want to invest it? Who do we want to invest it in? Those people who share our values and we see results from it, right? Chris, I can't tell you how happy I am for you and just how happy I am for your success. And you know, I'm happy for you, but I want to tell you just how proud I am of you. Dude, like you and I have known each other for a long time and having this opportunity to speak with you, you are really just an amazing person. And I'm really lucky to call you my friend. The program in this podcast mission is to develop great teammates and leaders to create world-class teams. Chris, mission accomplished. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Eric. I mean, part of this was therapy that just got us super excited about the things that we care the most about. So I hope that the listener has as much, you know, joy from this experience as we've had.
Yeah. Well, I certainly have had a lot. We didn't talk about them, but my love, to your family.
Thanks.
For our audience, our book, The Program, Lessons from Elite Military Units for Creating and Sustaining High-Performance Leaders and Teams. And by the way, Chris's book, as I that I talked about earlier, High Altitude Leadership, can be found at Barnes & Noble and Amazon. To sign up to receive the program's letter on leadership or to learn more about the program and our leadership development services for your own team, go to theprogram.org. Follow us on Twitter, Instagram, and Facebook at theprogram.org and on LinkedIn at theprogram.llc. If you've enjoyed today's program podcast, please leave a review of it on whatever platform you have accessed it from. Thank you, and attack.